From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump has, for much of his White House tenure, attempted to woo African Americans. He's touted massive gains in employment and other fields for this traditionally Democratic Party-leaning demographic. He has showcased token individuals to boast of Black support. But like America in general, Trump's promise to African Americans has been hollow. Now, in a new book of essays, outspoken writer and commentator Howard Bryant explores all the ways in which he sees an uneven playing field. Howard Bryant is a senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, and is a correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition. He's won several awards for his commentary writing, and his books include The Heritage, Juicing the Game, and The Last Hero. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. Welcome to the program, Howard.
No, thank you for having me.
So, of course, I didn't expect anything other than your book to open with the story of Colin Kaepernick, who I really feel in so many ways has symbolized the relationship between not just Trump and Black America, but America and Black America. Tell me how you see Colin Kaepernick's story, all of the sort of lessons that what he did and what has happened to him tells us about African Americans in 2019, 2020.
Well, I think what Colin Kaepernick represents to me, and one of the reasons why I was working on this essay in Full Dissidence, it's called What Colin Kaepernick Taught Us, is the enormous price that African Americans pay for advocating Black positions. I feel like in The Heritage, in my last book, one of the questions that I was really talking about was the rise of the athlete activist and moving back toward the 1960s with Muhammad Ali and Tommy Smith and John Carlos, and that you had this enormous power that players had today, as we see in the backdrop of Ferguson and some of these other issues. But then in Colin Kaepernick's case, I asked a different question in Full Dissidence. And that question is, how much power do you really have if you lose everything for opening your mouth? How much influence can you have if you risk your entire career? That doesn't sound like power to me. That sounds like sacrifice. And so it made me go back and think. And I think what it also taught me about America, what I was also trying to convey, was the enormous amount of aggression that you see on the part of white America when Colin Kaepernick really did nothing other than express his First Amendment rights, his ideas of what this country needed in terms of fairness. And you saw that even when Nike attempted to rehabilitate him simply by naming him as a spokesman, that you saw so many outlets and so many outlets in law enforcement and retail and a lot of white Americans try to boycott Nike, which told me an enormous amount as well, that you're going to actually try to boycott one of the biggest corporations in the world simply because they gave Colin Kaepernick a part-time job. That told me a lot about the distance between Black and white in this country. And Colin Kaepernick's at the center of it.
So as somebody who was a football player, an NFL player, the stance that he took was treated as not just a slap in the face of, you know, those people who back the national anthem and feel that we need blind patriotism, but also somehow this idea of America and also the military. And that has a lot to do with what you write about in your book, with the cultural influence of the U.S. military on football. Can you explore that a little?
Well, it's not just football, Sonali. It's also it's professional sports. When you think about our country and this nation, you think about how many different places, especially with technology, where the country is split. You got 300 channels now. Nobody's watching the same thing. The one place where people do come together is sports. And so this is a place that's used as an extremely important recruiting tool for the military. It's extremely important for policing. It's a place where you get the most eyeballs, and we've been fighting two, three wars for 20 years now, that this is a place where the military actually needs to recruit. And what I was getting at in another essay, which is called It's Okay to Criticize the Military, when you think about how much we've shifted toward the military, when you think about how difficult it is to even say anything dissenting about the fact that we have been at war for two decades, you realize that we're losing our voices, and you realize that that this move toward military and toward defense is coming at an extremely high price. And that price is student debt. You're looking at the numbers of kids today who are just drowning in debt. It's interesting to me that we talk about, whenever you talk about free college, or you talk about Medicare for all, or you talk about these different services, the very first thing that people say is, well, how are you going to pay for it? Yet, at the same time, we've got a $700 billion military budget, and nobody asked that same question.
Now, the issue of the military being something that we shouldn't question, tied up with the Kaepernick question, all folds into this idea that to be a good American, you worship the flag, you pay homage to the flag, you show a deference to power. And it seems to me that as long as, especially people of color and African Americans included, show that deference, they are praised and accepted. But of course, as soon as you speak out.
And the minute you speak out, it feels that everything that you have can be revoked. And that's actually one of the reasons for the title of the book, is that I reject that. And I feel that one of the major differences over the course of my lifetime, why I think that this moment in time is so important, is that for me, America has always been considered, whether it was in practice or not, but in ideal, it had always been considered aspirational, that you talk to Black people, you talk to whites and Asians and Latinos and everybody, and Middle Easterners, and everybody that comes to this country, the idea is we're not perfect, but we're getting there, that this is the place where you can go, where we aspire to the higher ideal, and that the flag represents that higher ideal. But what I've recognized over the past few years is that the flag is something to be obeyed. It's not something to aspire to. It's something to be obeyed. And if you don't obey it, you are now somehow less than American. And it's easy for people to then suggest that you don't, that you shouldn't even live here. And that's a major, major difference, because aspiration is really what this country is founded on in so many different ways. It's one of the reasons why people want to come here. They're not coming here for obedience. They're coming here for dreams, and they're coming here for aspiration.
And it's interesting to see a lot of those same people who embrace the flag, who criticize Colin Kaepernick, criticize authoritarianism in countries like China, but then claim that we have the freedom to speak out in the United States, except all those freedoms are theoretically available to us. It's just when we actually start using them that we are then shut out or criticized or dismissed as un-American. I want to talk about police. We talked about the military, and the sort of counterpart to our domestic law enforcement force is the police. Which is a force that has come under intense criticism because we can now document police crimes. But it seems to me that the treatment that Colin Kaepernick got for kneeling was very similar to the treatment that Black Lives Matter got for pointing out police brutality. And it was police brutality that Kaepernick was protesting when he knelt down, right?
No, that's right. And I think in one of the essays, it's called Copaganda, which is essentially the propaganda of police. And you look at what has happened in this country post 9/11. After the towers fell, you look at police and now they are treated as heroes, unquestioned heroes, not individually, but as a profession. And that's an incredibly dangerous precedent to set, because obviously there are all types of people who are good and competent and incompetent in a given profession. There are many, many good journalists. If I go out and make a mistake, I get sued. If the doctor operates on the wrong leg, they get sued for malpractice. But with policing, you have this blanket that police are untouchable, that police they are no longer open to any sort of scrutiny whatsoever. And so part of that reasoning is not just the hero worship of 9/11, it's also the hero worship in sports, where you have military appreciation night, you have law enforcement appreciation night. You have law enforcement appreciation nights in over 300 ballparks across the country every year. So at the same time you're telling people that we don't want politics from Colin Kaepernick, you come to the ballpark and people expect you to be deferential toward police. And you just can't have it both ways. I think also one of the areas that I try to explore in Copaganda in that chapter is, what else do we expect when policing is so much at the center of our pop culture? You look at your buddy movies and everything, it's always police at the center. And I ask the question in the essays, I do believe that we're over-policed. I think that we have this idea that this country is so much more dangerous than it actually is, when the actual murder rates in this country are the same as they've been probably over the last half century. But because policing is so much at the center, because we've decided that police are unassailable, what does that do for your juries? What does that do in terms of justice when you have police commit crimes? It's almost impossible to get a conviction. And what does that say for the people who feel like they are most in the bullseye when police are attacking them?
So the issue of, I'm so glad you brought up the issue of the buddy movies and how police are portrayed on screen. We have reality shows as well on the issue of, you know, the police appreciation events here locally where I am. Every time there's a block party, the police are invited to hang out with neighbors because we're expected to assume that these are our protectors. And indeed, of course, they're often claiming to protect and serve us. But that gut reaction kicks in, especially among people of color, that you seize up and you freak out internally when you're around a cop. And that comes from the fact that cops generate fear in us. We fear that we might be killed if we are people of color, but white people don't always feel that same fear. And that is such a huge indicator of everything that's wrong, right?
Yeah, and it's one of the great gaps in us. And this is one of the questions that I talk about in the book, where you have this conversation between people of the same class, even if they're not of the same race, and we've been friends for years, and we have the same values, and we have the same politics, supposedly. And then you start talking about these very specific issues, and then you realize the differences, and you see the gaps between you and the people around you, and you feel that isolation. And I think the other thing that happens when you're looking at this from a policing standpoint too, is this inherent nature that police are a force for good, when that's not the experience of the Black community or of communities of color. And so what then do you do with that space in between? And especially when you start to look at it, as we've seen in the phenomenon over the last several years of people calling the police on Black people in public spaces and people using sort of authority as a way to control Black people. In a lot of ways, you see this as a byproduct of post 9/11, the saying that you have on the East Coast, if you see something, say something. So we're talking about fear here. And what does that do to the people who are Americans, but they are also feared, meaning African Americans? If you see something, say something, has a very different connotation if you're already afraid of Black people.
And the issue of holding police accountable that are just barely started to gain some traction in the Obama mm-hmm. White House, with the Justice Department under Eric Holder starting to have some federal oversight of some police departments that were the most problematic, and consent decrees. All of that has been undone under Trump. He likes to talk about the amazing gains for African Americans under his presidency, but he never talks about police brutality or the criminal justice system, unless he's taking credit for Kim Kardashian's work.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is the idea that I have in the book. And the theme of that is the joke's on you, where we're talking about these different ways where the gap between authority and everyday citizens is getting larger and larger and larger. The joke is actually on us. You talk about taking the individual, especially, I think, if you watch the Super Bowl, you saw Donald Trump use his reelection ad to talk about his freeing of Alice Johnson, who had been unfairly imprisoned for 22 years. And at the same time, you have this commercial with her talking about praising Donald Trump for her individual freedom. You also notice that the Jeff Sessions Justice Department was actually incarcerating more people for marijuana, and having a greater relationship undoing some of the Obama era decrees on private prisons. And so on the one hand, you have this notion of Donald Trump taking credit for this one individual, but then if you're really paying more close attention, you're recognizing that the opposite is happening, that African Americans are actually being incarcerated at a higher rate.
Now, one of the related issues that's so critically important, but maybe doesn't get as much attention, is the issue of housing and schooling. Bread and butter issues, maybe not as sexy as some of the other issues, but that's so critically important. During his State of the Union address, President Trump made a big deal about awarding an opportunity grant to a young Black girl, which was basically, it seemed, a overt reference reference to privatization of schools. How critically important is the issue of public schooling and education funding? And also, when we talk about things like housing and segregation, we don't hear about this often enough. It seems as though employment numbers, employment figures are generally the only measure.
Yes, enormously important, especially when you think about it from the individual standpoint of identity. One of the things that I talk about in the book and some of the in a couple of the essays is about the necessity of taking African American children and placing them in a white background for the sake of better education. And then why don't we have better schools in our Black communities? And what is the intellectual price? On the one hand, there's obviously a gain that you're going to get by going to better schools, but what is the social and what is the price that you're paying emotionally on being the only Black person in class and having to go into some of these desegregation programs where you're going to school 90 minutes or 2 hours away from your home? What is the price that you're paying there? And what are we asking of our Black families? We're talking also about these enormous measures that you have to take simply for the opportunity of having a good education. And at the same time, when you're talking about that opportunity grant, it's a phenomenon that I refer to in the book as the hero game, whereas we are right. Failing policies, but we're looking for someone to save us. There's an opportunity grant here. There's Jay-Z and Beyonce paying for someone to go to college. There's Robert Smith at Morehouse paying for the graduation class and wiping out their student debt. So essentially you have this celebrity game of roulette where you are relying or hoping that some celebrity is going to come save the day and pay for your college when everybody else is drowning in debt. It's a very, very dangerous thing. But what it does do is it gives you the optics that we're doing so much better than we are. That LeBron James is out there building a school. Is that wonderful? Absolutely. Is that great? Absolutely. As long as it is a complement to policy and not replacing policy. And what I see, what I'm really worried about, and we see it all the time with these heartwarming human interest stories of the 10-year-old girl, making lemonade to pay for her parents, her mother's cancer treatments. This is not what we're talking about. And this is chilling. This is not, a heartwarming human interest story to me. It tells me that we've got much, much bigger problems in terms of inequality and in terms of the lack of services that people really need.
I'm so glad you brought up this issue. It's just shocking that in today's day and age, you even have, in some cases, health insurance companies suggesting to people whose treatments they won't cover that they might try crowdfunding online, because that is now what we have become.
And that is what we've become. And that is exactly what we're talking about. And this is what I refer to as my full dissidence moment, where you look at this and you take a step back and you look at where we are and you say, this isn't right. This isn't right across so many different levels. And I think that you start to put these pieces together. What are we focusing on? We're focusing on Kevin Durant playing for somebody's college, but then you look at everybody else. And you're saying this is not, it's getting away from us. This idea of the American value is getting away from us. And the celebrity game is overtaking the things that we consider to be important. And to me, I felt like you could feel it on the celebrity side when it comes to these commercials. You can feel it in terms of healthcare. You also feel it in terms of the private overtaking the public in terms of the lack of public wealth. And all of this is also taking place at a time when we're being told to speak less, to say less about military, to say less in sports, to say less about politics, to not get involved in these things at the same time when we really need to talk more. It's becoming more and more and more relevant.
Well, I have to ask you this, Howard. We are at a very critical juncture in this country, and a lot of the things that you are drawing attention to, not all, but a lot, are just massive failures of our current economic system. So what we, of course, desperately need is economic justice, racial justice, gender justice. We need so much more from our country. Where do you think those answers lie? Because Colin Kaepernick can only do so much as an individual. And if he's relying on the spotlight so that he can use his celebrity, but the spotlight is just not there for him, isn't the social movement of the same issues that he represents what we really need. Are you at all optimistic about how strong our movements are to fight for these things?
Indeed, it's got to come from the people, no question. And I think that one of the things that I try to get across in the book is that do not follow your celebrities. The celebrities are actually following the people. Mm. And when you think about it in terms of sports, you think about it in terms of labor, all of these issues, in terms of education, with the teachers going on strike in red states like West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, the people are actually still leading us. And what my concern is, and what I'm really, really nervous about, is the idea that we need to rely on some celebrity concierge. If you go hop on CNN International for just a few minutes, you still see the power of people. You see the people in the streets and in countries across the world. And there's no government that can ever respond to the power of the people with any negativity for long. Eventually, if there are enough people out there, you have to respond to it. Where is my optimism? I still feel like the optimism that you have has to come from the ability of the people to recognize when they are being hurt. And when they recognize that they aren't supposed to lean into this, they can't lean into it anymore. When I talk about the joke being on you, or when we talk about wealth inequality or all these different subjects, I think that one of the biggest fears that I have, or the areas where I despair the most, is the fact that you have more and more and more money buying elections and buying the cabinets and buying all of these different things. I believe that in one of the essays, I talk about the fact that you have billionaires in the cabinet, that this country is being designed right now is to be aggressive against workers and to deregulate education, to deregulate the interior, to deregulate energy, and to really give everything away to the corporations. I do, however, have a lot of optimism when you read writers like Ibram Kendi, or you read writers like Naomi Klein, and especially Naomi Klein and her ability to talk about the environment and to get people involved in recognizing that you've got to take a stand on this now. When I talk about full dissidence, I don't talk about it necessarily in terms of pessimism. I talk about it in terms of some optimism that you see through what's happening right now, and it's incumbent upon us to take that stand and to move forward and realize they're not going to save us. They're actually oppressing us.
Well, Howard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your insight. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
My guest has been Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. He's also a correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition. He's won several awards for his commentary writings. His previous books are The Heritage, Juicing the Game, and The Last Hero. We've been talking about his latest book, Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.